Dirt. Okay, we
Got
are
it.
recording now, so we can cut this.
Fantastic.
No, yes, it's an honor to be here. I've really enjoyed your Substack when I've been reading from what I've been reading, and as I said, I think it's really important at this moment in time that we get as much dialogue as we possibly can between the Muslim and the Christian world.
I agree as well. And especially considering the fact that, let's just be honest here and call a spade, the publics of Europe and North America do not want World War III. So, and we're kind of stepping in that direction. So definitely dialogue, even though the hour is late, it's definitely required at this point.
I mean, I think a problem we run into within the West, one of our big defining myths is the myths of chivalry, the myths of the great battles against the heathens of the heathen like Panem of the East. And in reality, the Crusades were essentially 150 years of Europe getting its ass kicked out of the Holy Land. I mean, that's seriously, that's exactly what happened is they ran into the same problem we see in Israel today. You had a small kingdom surrounded by hostiles of a different religion. You had to be supported by offshore stuff. You had to be supported by trade. You had to be supported by trade. You had to ship your military. You had to ship your military in, just like Israel has to ship weapons in. And they just couldn't hold against that constant pressure from the Islamic world. I mean, it also didn't help that most of the Western conquerors were, not particularly good strategians, and then they found themselves up against Saladin. So,
Yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think that's something, and that has really hurt. We have this idea, because we hear the heroic stories of like us conquering the Muslims. Although interestingly, I have not been able to find a Western story that has a bad thing to say about Saladin from the medieval era. Not one Christian medieval thing. Everybody, including people who lost to him, speak exceedingly highly of Saladin. So there's stuff like that I find interesting.
So there's a reason for that, right? And Saladin, may Allah be pleased with him, right? Radiallahu anhu. The thing with him is that he didn't just pop up in the void, so to speak, right? There were people before him and generations before him who were preaching in the market squares, near the public spaces near the mosque and what have you about, oh, Muslims, your lands are occupied, who will rise up, right? So you had several generations of that, and that's actually what built up a figure like Saladin. And the thing with that is Dr. Shadi Al-Masri, he's in New Jersey, and he's a Malikiya scholar. He's got like a very nice, I wouldn't call it a history series per se, but it's almost like a brief biographical style thing he does, where he kind of builds that up in the sense that, okay, we're going to talk about two generations prior to Saladin, then we're going to talk about one generation prior to that, and so on and so forth, right? And he does that. I'm actually going to, when I post this to my stack, and I guess you're also going to simultaneously post with me as well, maybe what I'll do is I'll send you the link to some of those things he did as well.
That
People
would be
will, might be able
fantastic.
to, yeah,
I'm in
because
New
if
Jersey. That's the other thing that's kind of
nice.
interesting.
Very nice. So maybe I'll even send you the address. But no, he's very nice, very knowledgeable scholar of the religion. But no, the thing that you were saying, which is that the mythology of victory. Now, from our end of things, where things stand, is that 1096, you guys call it Common Era. For our calendar, it's about I think it's about 400 Hijri or something. I have to double check. But anyhow, so they got that first victory. The Crusaders got it 1096, 1099. And then you had a string of victories, right? I mean, you can even honestly just go to Wikipedia or some other place and you can just quickly read. You can just quickly read some of the stuff in the sense that for the first few decades or so, we did not actually have a single victory. And the reason has to do with a couple of things, right? The arrows couldn't penetrate through the armor. You had like the heavy cavalry tactics. Also, you've got like flat terrain, the manner in which you kind of move the infantry around, lots of stuff, right? So, and also add in the fact that the Muslim rulers were exceptionally corrupt at that time. And the fact that, well, they were divided internally. You could kind of bribe them off. So everything kind of hodgepodge together. It, you know, individually, not one thing could be like, okay, well, that's a defeater, right? But if you take it all together, that's when it becomes a problem, right? That's when it becomes an issue. So that's basically what happened to us.
Things were strained kind of the way, you know, I would say the Israeli government was strained at this point. It was just waiting for something to pop. And what popped was, you know, the Normans who come in from that crusade, that's a really interesting story. I mean, as late as the 10th century, you know, 9th century, I think for all, they were facing raids in France from pagan Vikings, pagan Norsemen. So they give them a little piece of land on the French coast, on the Mediterranean coast. You know, the Northmen come there. We call it Normandy today. The Anglo-Normans find, you know, they convert to Christianity. They get settled. And within a generation or two, these people who, according to the pagan customs of Northern Europe, were like, you know, we will go to Valhalla and we will be with Odin if we die bravely in battle, are like, you know, well, we will go to heaven and we'll be with God if we die bravely, you know, for the faith. And so they take over England. You know, you get the, like, the hate in 1066. Then they start spreading to the Holy Land. And what you have is berserker warriors. I mean, they weren't particularly skilled in terms of, you know, these guys weren't trained in Roman fighting. They weren't trained in, like, any really particular kind of fighting other than charge forward.
But they managed
to get it there. You know, they hit by that. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting when you read the accounts from us, it'd be like, you know, okay, well, now that you guys got this land, you know, people come, you know, well, are you going to be building a bath, you know, a public bath here? They're like, well, why would we want a public bath? And they're kind of just looking at them like, you know, why would you want a public bath? You know, like, because, like, hygiene, you know. And they didn't get that. And that was like, I mean, literally to them, this looked like a bunch of filthy, unwashed barbarians who just suddenly showed up on the shores, took things over. And, you know, they had very little to offer. On the other hand, you know, we did get trade routes going at that time. And that's something we miss in the West, I think, about the Crusades. Because the Arthurian cycle is so important to us, because that whole myth of the great knights coming in to retake the Holy Land what we miss is, most of the time, you know, we spent centuries trading between Christians and Muslims. You know, certainly Byzantium and the Muslims traded, the Venetians traded. We got along. You know, we spent more time getting along with each other than we did fighting with each other.
Yeah, agreed. And the thing is, right, if you look at Europe, right, and I'm going to maybe invoke a bit of Professor Alexander Dugin here, but Europe is basically a peninsula. That's basically what it is, right? And a peninsula can only function insofar as it's connected to the heartland, right? And this is where the Geopolitics 101 comes in of Mackinder. And obviously, you know, there's things Mackinder says, which us modern people, we can kind of like correct him on, right? But overall, the simple fact of the matter is that the, like you were saying, right, the Arthurian stuff and what have you, Europe's pressures are very, very different than the rest of the world, right? Like China, for example, views itself almost as, you know,
China is the navel of the world.
Yeah. We're
the
middle basically, of the earth. China is the navel of the world. We are basically at the center. And, you know, they have, like, you know, practically speaking, they have good reason to think that. I mean, they got so many people, right? I mean, for most of human history, most people either lived in India or China, right?
Yeah.
And so from their point of view, it kind of makes sense. Now, for Europe, right, for most of human history, Europe was just a backwater, right? It was a peninsula, right? And the peninsula was populated by these nomadic tribesmen, right, who are moving around warring with each other. That's basically what happened, right? And so civilization, up until the Roman Empire came, right? Prior to the Roman Empire, you just had a bunch of tribes all over the place. I think before the Roman Empire, they never really got the idea.
You know, with most of Europeans, you know, they never got the idea they wanted more gold than they could carry away, or they never wanted more land than they could plow and use for themselves. They thought in terms of small towns. They thought in terms of, and that's, you know, the way they always were, you know, small communities. There was never anything interesting, you know, culturally or intellectually going on in Western Europe till this brief 300-year just amazing flash.
And also, what do you call it? This brief 300-year flash that we are in right now is really, if you think about it, right, like Columbus discovered the New World, right? But I always ask people, okay, well, why is it the case that he was looking for the alternate route, right? Like that word right there, the word alternate, should give you a clue as to what's going on, right? Because what happened was when Constantinople fell, and you know later became Istanbul and what have you, right? But when that place fell, the Bosphorus was basically owned by the Ottomans, right? And you couldn't have trade pass through. And so the Europeans are like, you know, see, even back then, even though they hated on us Muslims and they called us all kinds of stuff and they kind of hated on all the other people, they knew their identity, right? The people of that time knew that, okay, we are a peninsula. We need to get trade coming into the peninsula. Otherwise, we're basically screwed, right? So that's the reason why Columbus was trying to discover the New World. He was trying to, quote unquote, lift the blockade that the Ottomans had put on all of Europe, right? And also, that was one thing, right? But what was the other thing? The other thing was, okay, we need to get to India. But why do we need to get to India? Well, India is this land with lots of people and lots of riches.
And when we get the gold, it was a huge deal.
It was a huge deal. But like, see, the thing with India is that, but what do you need the gold and silver for? And this is where it all comes back full circle. You need the gold and silver to finance an army that you can then build up and invade Palestine and lift the blockade, right? Mm-hmm. That Europe is in, right? Because Europe is closed off, right? If the Ottomans have the Bosphorus, so we got to conquer the Holy Land and we got to open it up again. Right. And see, back then, people were intelligent. Right. They knew these things. Right. Nowadays, you go to European leaders and they think they're hot stuff. Right. They think that, oh, you know, Europe can go on its own. It can become a superpower. All this other nonsense. Right. European Union is an utter basket case. Right. They've forgotten.
European Union is a joke. Yeah. European Union. Yeah. Okay, we are running into a problem here. What's going to make this next big conflict interesting? There is nobody today who is in the military, who's in a position of power, who remembers with firsthand lived experience a multi-front world conflict.
Yes, that's correct.
That's really, you know, I mean, nobody here, nobody in any military anywhere in the world has ever really faced something the size of, not even a World War II, a World War I. You know, we've never faced like a continental war, never mind a multi-continental war.
Yeah.
And we're at a place where we're looking at, you know, right now, you know, Ukraine could flash, China could flash, Iran could flash. And America would have a very hard time if they were able to win against in any one of those conflicts. One of those conflicts would be a bloodbath. All three of them at once, forget it.
Yeah. And the thing is, there's a commentator by the name of Malcolm Chayune. He's mostly on Twitter, but I think he writes for a Compact magazine and a couple of these other places. But he said something very nice. He said that Americans have this idea that the military is like a DoorDash driver. So you just pick up the phone, you call him in, he drives over, he dumps the food and he drives away. That's basically how leadership in America and the European vassals, that's how they view the military, right? But like you were saying, right, nobody knows what logistics is. Nobody knows what supply is, right? If you've got 400,000 American troops, right? And I'm being very generous, right? Like, we both know that that's not the real number, because it's
we'd
not
be lucky 400, if that 400,000 is 100,000 that were actually
infantry.
Confident.
Exactly. And like, if you convert it to infantry, right, like people who actually put their boots and then go on the ground and fight, it's probably far less than that. It's probably smaller than that. I seem to recall the thing
was what I'd heard with Israel was like, okay, Israel has 400,000 people in its army. Of that group, maybe 50,000 to 60,000 is capable of doing army duty. And of that group, there's a smaller percentage that's really, you can send them in for urban warfare and it's going to be anything other than a shooting match.
Correct. Most of the 500,000, I think that their official number prior to this conflict is 530,000, right? So like you were saying, right, it's like 530,000. Most of them are HR people. Most of them, in terms of combat experience, they have experience being military police, like bullying women and kids and babies, right?
Yeah.
And you've got a few maybe special forces here and there who use like technology and flashy gadgets. But really, when it comes to hand-to-hand, street-to-street fighting, they don't have like, this is not Israel of 1967 or 1973.
Yeah, no.
This is a very different military animal, and it's a very, very atrophied muscle, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it's an atrophied muscle, right, it's going to, like, the thing with atrophied muscles is that they spasm a lot, right? And this is precisely what you're seeing right now, right? You're seeing, like, I think Syed Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech he did about a few days ago, he was basically saying that, look, our official numbers is that 14,500 are the real numbers with regard to wounded in action, unsanitary, and killed in action, right? And if you actually do the math on that, that is crazy, right? Because if you
have about 40% of the useful fighters.
Exactly. And so this is why, the military leadership of Israel are already talking about drafting the Haredi, right? And if you know about anything about Israeli society, the fact
drafting
that
the Haredi, they're going to be cannon fodder.
Exactly. And like, for people who don't know what we're talking about, the Haredi are like the super Orthodox Jewish folks in
Israel.
They're
the black hat Jews with the side locks. They're the ones who dress up like Fiddler on the Roof.
Exactly. And they're the guys who are like, oh, we're going to have 10 kids, but the 10 kids, the girls are always going to be indoors and the boys are only going to study Torah all day. That's like, Israeli society has a love-hate relationship with them. They love them because they basically have lots of kids and they pump up the population numbers, but they hate them because they can't be drafted into the military. They're basically like,
they won't
you know,
be
a
drafted
bunch of...
in the military and essentially live on public assistance. Yeah,
that's... exactly. That's basically what it is, right?
Yeah.
So,
but
no,
there's no, I mean, there is no thing. You hit something really important when you said flashy gadgets. It's a problem with Israel and it's a huge problem with the American army. We've come to rely, and this is a late stage imperial thing, on really advanced technological gadgets. I mean, Israel has its Iron Dome. What I remember hearing on October 7th was that they were able to get past a fence into Gaza because the fence was so sensitive. Cats were triggering it. Dogs were triggering it. You were getting false alarms, you know, once or twice a day. So nobody noticed when the fence was cut. And by the time they noticed the fence was cut, it was already cut and they'd already poured in. The Iron Dome. We have stuff like the F-35 that, like, you know, flyers nicknamed the Penguin. They've spent, you know, I think hundreds of billions at this point on that thing, and it's useless. You know, we've got a lot of extremely expensive stuff, and we're fighting people who, you know, have, I think it's the Palestinian Ghouls, those rifles they're building themselves in, like, you know, in the tunnels. They've got gunsmiths.
Yeah, the Ghoul rifle. So the Ghoul rifle can be put together for under $300. And that's assuming you make it out of metal that you kind of purchase. But if you go to like a scrapyard and you just salvage the stuff yourself, you can actually make it for less than $100.
Yeah, that's and it's we're fighting people like that. You've got one of the problems, the Byzantines ran into this with Greek fire. You get an extreme, well, we got this complex missile battery that could do, you know, everything but toast your bread. Well, yeah, but that means there are thousands of different little parts there, and if any one of those little parts go kerblooey, you've got a big pile of scrap metal.
100%.
That's been a
100%.
huge problem with America. Israel, they were relying on technology. You know, we got the super technology. You know, what are a bunch of barbarians going to do against like our super camera, elite super camera system and against our missiles? It's like, I don't know. How'd those goat herders in Afghanistan do?
I mean, people say goat herder like it's an insult, but goat
Yeah.
herders actually do something productive for the economy. Like, what are you doing productive? Like, whenever people say the word goat herder, my thing
Yeah.
is like, okay, my friend, what do you do for the economy? And normally people who make the criticism, it's like some idiot service sector job. And I'm like, dude,
Yeah.
you're not even producing anything productive.
One of
Like,
the
you're
first
like what?
wars, the first war, it's in the Bible, is like was between pastoral people who had sheep and like agricultural people that were growing land because you needed
One
agriculture
thousand
to build
percent.
big cities. So, you know, yeah, those
Exactly.
pastoral people have been fighting with you city folks in your big gardens and your food, like in the food you grow. You know, they've been fighting with you for thousands of years, and every time you come into the pastures to fight them, you leave with your tail between your legs. That's
Excellent point. Excellent point. Yeah, no, it's quite funny, right? Like, they try to pretend, you know, this is actually, and you were touching on this, right? At the beginning, honestly, the West has gotten to the point where only mythology is left, right? And it has to mythologize about itself a certain way. But when you actually unpack, or when you like peel back the onion, rather, there's really nothing left there, right? I mean, it's like, oh, goat herder, right? They use goat herder as an insult when it's actually not an insult. It's actually a very noble profession, right? Number one. Number two, they talk about their technology, right? But their technology is just utter junk, right? I mean, you know, if it like Donald Trump said it best, he's like, okay, well, if I'm competing against a guy, right, and he's builds this giant hotel for loads of money, and I build like a hotel next door with cheaper, and I get more like serviced in him, right? The fact that he spent more money, that's not a good sign, right? But for
Yeah.
some reason, we've been conditioned to think that, yeah, if you dump more money into the military, right, it apparently
We
it's
throw
supposed to be like a
lots of
good thing
money
now.
at the military. That's a lot of corruption in military procurement. There has always been corruption in military procurement. And by that, I mean, you know, the Greeks were having problems with people stealing supplies meant for soldiers. You
Exactly.
know, it's. This has always been the case. We've got this huge bloated industry. We're trying to create these things. You know, the one I remember just hearing is they created a new destroyer, and it's got this super secret shape that makes it hard to spot with radar. But the problem is the way it's built, you can't get it really close to the beach for an amphibious a invasion, and well, that's one of the main purposes it was built for.
So
So
basically,
you
it
got it
can't do its
useless.
job.
It can't do
It
its job.
basically can't do its job. Yeah, so there you go.
And here it can't do its job. Their response was, well, we're going to put hypersonic missiles on it, and that's going to make it. It's like, okay, we haven't, America has not yet, to my knowledge, successfully fired a hypersonic missile. I believe both China and Russia have. We don't
They have a
have.
design concept. America has a design concept. Meanwhile, everyone's already built it. And Yemen's Ansarallah, in my previous article, I basically noted that Yemen's Ansarallah already tested something. So, yeah,
Yeah. It's
America's
like,
basically in the
okay,
dust right now.
they're in the dust, but it's like the thing with hypersonic missiles. There are uses for hypersonic missiles. There's not a lot you can do with a hypersonic missile that you can't do with an IC, with a continent, with a regular missile that's going at like sonic, supersonic speeds. There are things you can do. You can avoid some, you know, it's not useless, but the cost of a hypersonic mi firing a hypersonic missile versus the cost of firing a supersonic missile versus the cost of firing a drone. That's where we're
The
running
main
into
thing,
it.
The main thing with a hypersonic is that it's low altitude, right? And the thing with radar, conventional radar, is that you're looking for cross-sectional what do you call it? Cross-sectional area rather, right? So when you beep out the waves, right, it has to hit something and then it has to come back to you, right? But if the thing is too low to the ground, right,
It
what you
can't.
get back is not enough, right? And Andrei Martyanov, I think I'm going to link him, but he has a very interesting article. He goes over this in his trilogy of books, but he gives you all the mathematical formulas. He gives you like the differential equations and the partial differential equations. But basically, if you want like a one-line motto, the one-line motto is as follows: if you can see something, you can kill it. If you are unable to be seen, you cannot be hit, right? So that's basically what it comes down to. So the lower you go altitude-wise, right, the lower the signature you give off with regard to cross-sectional area, because you're moving too fast. And even though the radar is picking it up, right, it doesn't have enough of a certainty cloud, right, to compute. Because at the end of the day, like, warfare at this level is all about probability. It's all about probability and certainty. It's like, okay, we know he's got a big hunk of metal somewhere. Where do we find the hunk? You know, how do we find the hunk of metal? Oh, we see the hunk of metal now. Bam, shoot it, dead,
I
right?
think
That's
we
basically
ran
what it
into
comes
a
down to.
problem with our stealth bomber, which we were working on. We spent
Yeah,
billions on that
stealth.
stuff.
Stealth is exactly like stealth is a dead concept. Like Martyanov literally has like seven different videos, and he literally goes over the mathematics. He literally shows you why stealth is a dead concept, right?
Well, I think what
When
happened was they found out something to the effect of like, okay, well, this gives roughly the same profile to radar as a sparrow. It's like, well, good, look for a sparrow that's flying 500 miles an hour, and there you go.
There you go, right? So and the thing is, right, what do you call it? It's not just that it's a sparrow flying at 5,000. It's also the fact that Russian radar, right, and a lot of the like Russian ISR in general, right, especially all of the satellites, they're already surpassing their American counterparts with regard to connectivity and whatnot, like talking to one another, right? Martyanov goes over this. There's other people who go over this as well. I think actually, like, he had a essay in the Naval Proceedings from like 7 years ago, like literally 7 years ago. He was talking about this stuff. He's like, guys, you know, you're kind of getting left behind, right? You should probably stop wasting money. Because I think back in the day, he used to work for either Boeing or one of those bigger companies. But now I think he's retired, because like Boeing is so corrupt. Literally, the wheels are falling off of the stupid aircraft and
Planes.
whatnot. But no, like he was saying that stealth is a dead concept. You can basically get the signature, and if you can't get the signature, the Russians have gotten to the point where their certainty matrix is sufficient to, because at the end of the day, right, what does it come down to? It comes down to human reaction time and making decisions, right? If I fire a bullet at you, right, but you can basically see it coming at you at a slow enough speed, you can basically do the matrix thing and like dodge it, right? So it really comes down to, can you make decisions, right? So a jet hype, you know, like, I don't know, one of those what should we call it? Those big fat bombers, or a strategic fortress, a stratofortress, the American stratofortress, that thing, right? I forget the code for it. But anyway, so if it's flying, right, it's flying up there at such a slow speed, you have so much time to see it, to figure out, oh, you know, where exactly is it probably going? If I fire in this way, what's going to happen? And so on and so forth, right? So that's a very big certainty cloud, a very big probability matrix, and you can make lots of decisions, right? Versus something that's moving much faster, like one of the smaller so-called stealth jets, right? The Russians have it to the point where, okay, it's a smaller cloud to work with, but it's still sufficiently big enough to make the decisions that need to be made, right? And this is where the S-500 system comes in, and the S-550 and whatnot. And when they say that, oh yeah, this thing can shoot down satellites, that's basically what it can do, right? And they've gotten the testing data to back that up as well. So like, I've seen Americans say that, oh no, this is all bluff, you know, these guys, you know. I think one of the people at Military Info, one of these other channels, don't quote me on this, but he was basically saying, oh no, you know, the Russians are bluffing, they're overselling the thing, it can't shoot down satellites. I'm like, bro, did you see the math on it? And did you see the test data? Like it's 100% it's going to shoot down these things, right? So no, America's been left behind. I mean, like I said, Martianov covers it in his trilogy of books. Other people have covered it as well. So
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so Zoom has this 40-minute thing. Oh, yeah, no, I've not been on Zoom for such a long time. I forgot about it.
Yeah, so I was thinking...
I mean, we can keep going. We can keep going, and I guess what we can do is maybe we can do, like, part one, part two, part three.
That's kind of what I was thinking of doing, is just doing here till when the recording fades up, we'll give them this, then we'll be like, okay, this is the recording. Yeah. But, yeah, what I've got, what we got here, I think, is excellent. We're, like, getting a lot of stuff that I haven't heard people talking about. But, yeah, no, I mean, I think just we're not set up for a war. We're not. The United States is not set. We're not ready to handle a war.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of tensions because everybody, all the sharks are smelling the blood in the water. Everybody knows the American empire is not what it used to be. That's, you know, thing with Israel. If Israel loses the American empire, Israel becomes a one-state solution with a Jewish Palestinian and other population, and they figure out how to live with each other, and they will do that, because this would not be the first time that Jews have lived in a Muslim community peacefully and gotten along well. In fact, historically speaking, you were better off as a Jew in the Ummah than you were as a Jew in the Christian world, historically, for most of history.
Yeah. Yeah, if you look at medieval documents, right, and you can literally go to the archives and find this stuff. But one of the chief complaints Christians made about the Muslims was that whenever the Muslims used to show up and they would take up housing and residence, right behind them, the Jews would follow. Right. That's basically the chief complaint they had about us, in the sense that, oh, you know, these Muslims, they're bringing the Jews right behind them. Right. And we can't live with the Jews because, you know, they killed Christ. Right. So. Yeah.
That's the whole thing, is this, the current situation of tension between Jews and Muslims exists, frankly, solely because of Israel. You get rid of Israel, and there's really no reason for Muslims and Jews to have any beef with each other.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And the thing is, if you actually study the Axis of Resistance official documents, that's basically what they say. They're like, we're not against Jews and Judaism. What we're against is Zionism, right? And not every, like, you know, there's 15 million Jewish people who practice their faith to varying degrees. And if you take a more expansive definition, it's 23 million. If you, like, there's 8 million additional people who consider themselves culturally Jewish or ethnically Jewish, right? But out of those people, really, you're only talking about maximum 25% to one-third, maximum. And everyone else is either pro-Palestine, right? Or they're of the view that, okay, you know what? I don't believe that Israel should cease to exist, but I'm not pro-Israel either because I can't, like, support this stuff, right? And that's basically the majority of Jewish people all across the world. So, you know, there's peace-loving Jewish people, there's fair-minded, and they will really, like, what was the selling point the Israelis made? They're like, well, we need a Jewish state because otherwise we will not be safe. I mean, look at World War II. Look at all the bad stuff that happened to us. But really, Israel, through its existence, has demonstrated that it has made Jews less safe all over the world because it has brought up all these grudges. It has done all this stuff, right? And this is why a lot of Jewish people say, you know, not in my name, you know, don't claim to speak on behalf of me, right? And they're called, like, self-hating Jews or whatever, that nonsense, right?
Yeah,
but these are intelligent people. They know what they stand for. They know what they stand for, right? And, like, you know, when you look at a guy like Netanyahu and, like, his goons, right? Like, these people are the furthest thing from religion that one can, like,
ethno-nationalists, they're not religious nationalists. Yeah, no, and ethno-nationalism is an especially hard sell nowadays. And that's, you know, it's, I think... they got unconditional support from the United States, largely, you know, not because the elders of Zion were rubbing their hands together, but because we have an enormous Christian evangelical population in the United States that believes that Jesus is going to come back when the Jews run their Jewish kingdom and they have a third temple. And from a theological perspective, as speaking as a Roman Catholic Christian, this stuff is nonsense. The third temple doesn't matter to me theologically. You know, I mean, you can build a third temple there. You can build a shopping mall on that site. You know, that's your religion. It's not my religion. It has, you know, it's it has no more to do with
Yeah, exactly. And if they tried to even hurt a single brick of Al-Aqsa, right, Muslims would not stand for it, right? And I've got this, shall we say, I've got this very simple way of explaining it to people. But the 2 billion plus Muslims that live on planet Earth, they view Al-Aqsa, like people say, oh, it's the third holiest site, but they don't realize how significant it is, right? It is the site of the ascension of our Master Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, right? That is where he went up and received the five daily prayers from Allah Most High. So the significance of the site is such that if even a single brick is hurt, what will happen is Muslims will take action. Now, you could argue, oh, well, Muslims will not do anything because we've bribed all the Muslim leaders. Look at them. They don't do anything. Ha ha.
We've bribed IMF's all the Muslims leaders. Yeah. The Muslims leaders couldn't handle it.
Exactly. Right. Right. This is the argument people make. They're like, oh, the World Bank has them by the, you know what, right? They've grabbed them by the, you know what, and they can't do anything. Well, there's a few assumptions in what they're saying. Number one, they're assuming that state actors are the only thing on the table, right? Sub-state actors are also on the table, right? And I can tell you right now.
Exactly. Sub-state actors are what you got to worry about. Yeah. You got a few dozen independent actors on dirt bikes can cause a whole lot of problems.
Yeah.
You know, it's against a big army.
Yeah. We're getting to the last two minutes. You know what we should do, good sir? I think what we should do is we should make this audio clip, we should simultaneously post it on both our channels. And then I guess the next two parts, we can make it like paid content or what have you. Because if people enjoy this stuff, I think they'll be willing to listen to more of this stuff, I think.
Good idea. I agree. The pact is sealed. Yeah. Why don't we like start wrapping this up here and we'll continue the conversation. But yeah, I think we're in a real we're in a really good place here. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I feel like we're talking about a lot of important topics that aren't getting attention in the West.
100%, 100%. And like, I think this is a good place to segue and stop on part one. Part two, I'll expand on the sub-state actors element thing more, because people really need to understand that this is not the world of the 1950s where something happens on some other part of the world and you're just going to be safely tucked away two oceans away. Like that's not the world you live in anymore, right? Whether you like to admit it or not, folks, globalization, even if it's over, and even if, you know, we're going back to great power conflict, the fact of the matter is that sub-state actors and the fact that you've got this connectivity, it's going to have these consequences now. So, okay, it's saying less than a minute. So I guess, would you like to cut it off?
Let's cut the recording here.